BHB family, what's happening? This is Coach Coop here with another episode of BHB Radio. Tonight, I am joined by the sleep doctor, Dr. Michael Bruce. He's been on Oprah. He's been on Dr. Oz. He's been on a number of news media outlets from the Wall Street Journal all the way to the New York Times and dozens in between. He is the world's preeminent expert on sleep, considered one of the top 10 most influential people in the sleep space. He was voted the number one sleep expert in California by Reader's Digest. And tonight, he's here to talk to us about how to bulletproof your sleep. That's right, everything from various tips, sleep hygiene, light exposure advice, how nutrition can influence your sleep. Sleep is intertwined with everything from our immunology to our energy to our mood to actually adapting to our exercise and training so we can get results from it. So it's really the cornerstone, and there are people out there, a lot of people and growing, that think that sleep is not only just as important as training and nutrition, but maybe even more important than nutrition. So that being said, we also have another favorite guest of ours on today. That is Gary Millett. You guys might remember Gary from a few episodes in the past. Gary is a nutritional science researcher with an emphasis in the exogenous ketone space. Gary has been a part of a lot of industry-leading research, and we always love to have Gary on. He is going to basically help tie the nutrition piece into the discussion with Dr. Bruce, and we're going to have a nice, awesome roundtable when it comes to your sleep and how to optimize it. As always, this show is brought to you by Real Ketones, the pioneers in the exogenous ketone space. Be sure to check out realketones.com to try one of their cutting-edge exogenous ketone products and to have a full-fledged educational database at your fingertips, including things like apps, nutrition plans, guides, tools, and a full-on community, and more. So be sure to check them out at realketones.com. All right, guys, without further ado, let's get to the show. Good evening, everyone. This is Coach Matt, and you are listening to Better Health and Body Radio, your source for the latest and greatest information and understanding in the world of health, nutrition, and performance, where we give you a seat at the table next to the best and the brightest minds to arm you with the information you need to optimize yourself. Join us for another exciting, thought-provoking episode of BHB Radio, starting now. All right, Dr. Bruce, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I'm familiar with your work. Gary's familiar with your work. You know, you've written, at least 3 books. You're a world-renowned sleep doctor. Can you tell the audience a little bit more about who you are and how you got into what you're doing now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So my name is Michael Bruce. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, but I am medically board certified in clinical sleep disorders. So anybody who's listening should be like, hold on a second. He just said he has a PhD and now he just said he's medically board certified. How does that happen? So I am the crazy guy who took the medical specialty boards without going to medical school and passed. I'm one of 168 people in the world that have ever done it.
Wow.
And I specialized in sleep. And I've been an actively practicing sleep specialist for the last 19 years. I've had an interesting career. I had a career where I saw 30 patients a day, read 15 sleep studies a night. I had a part of my career where I was helping people run and operate sleep laboratories across the country. And then I worked with a company you may have heard of called WebMD. I was their sleep expert for 15 years, developing content and things like that. Then I was very fortunate. I started writing books because I was interested in having a bigger effect. You know, when you only see 30 patients a day, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. It was great. I helped 30 people a day, which is kind of awesome. But, you know, when you get on a podcast or a radio show, or you get a chance to do television or write a book, you can help thousands and thousands, if not millions of people. And that was very attractive to me. And so started writing books. Believe it or not, people wanted me on TV. When you're the WebMD sleep expert, that's easy to find. They just started calling up and saying, hey, Michael, would you be interested in doing an interview? And as you can probably already tell, I'm a little bit of a ham. I don't mind the attention. So I was happy to get on board and be on TV and start educating people about sleep, and ended up moving out to Los Angeles, and because my son wanted to be an actor. Thankfully, he is not an actor. he goes to USC now. I really turned into more of a high performance sleep coach, which was something different. So I'm not exactly hitting people with sleep disorders any longer. Although, of course, I've treated, you know, thousands of people with apnea, insomnia, narcolepsy, restless legs. Now it's really about how do we improve the quality of your sleep? How do you, if you don't have a sleep disorder, but you have crappy sleep, how do you get better sleep? That's really what I've been focusing in on. In my third book, which was called The Power of When, what I did was I identified people by these things called their chronotypes. So you might not have heard of the term, but you've actually heard of the concept before. If anybody's ever called you an early bird or a night owl, those are chronotypes. My contribution to the literature for the third book was I found a fourth chronotype, an insomnia type of chronotype. And by the way, these are genetic. You can see them on the PER3 gene. As a matter of fact, you can see a single nucleotide polymorphism or a SNP on there that changes and makes some people early and some people late, which is pretty fascinating when you think about it. And then, you know, moving forward, I have a new book coming out all about energy. So what we did was we took our four chronotypes, which we've got a lot of literature on, over 200 studies have been done on the chronotypes, and we layered on body types. So if you remember way back in high school, like endomorph, mesomorph, ectomorph.
Of course.
So I took those body types on top of the four chronotypes, and magic happened. We ran it through about 5,000 people who had taken the quiz. And what we discovered very quickly was that people, interestingly, have an affinity for certain exercise based on their body type. And so what we did was we put an intermittent fasting program together with a sleep program, together with a movement program. And that is my new book called Energize, How to Go from Dragging Ass to Kicking It in 30 Days. And it really personalizes an entire routine for you and teaches you a lot about energy. And I feel, you know, like I've been very fortunate. I get to do a lot of work with a lot of really cool companies. I get to learn a lot about technology and new tech that's coming into the field. And I get to test a lot of it in our research lab. So I've really gone from being a total clinician to now really only a slightly part-time helping out coach and really working with a lot of companies to further advance technologies to help people sleep better. So it's been a fun ride so far.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I totally hear you how you wanted to kind of branch out and help even a wider audience with this. So that makes a ton of sense. And I know Gary and I have some things we wanted to get into. I just actually wanted to mention though, your last book, wasn't that inspired by a like triple cardiac event that you had too, kind of a health crisis of your own?
So yes, so Energize was that. So I, you know, as all alpha males do, I, you know, burned the candle at 20 different ends. And I ended up having a cardiac event in the middle of a restaurant. My wife was not happy with me at that time. The good news was, is I was actually sitting with two physicians when it happened. So I'm still here.
There we go. Around the right people.
I know, right?
If you're going to have a heart attack or a heart issue, you've got to be around the right people.
I know, right? It was funny. We were out to dinner with this husband and wife couple, and they were both physicians. They saw it coming. I didn't even see it coming. And, you know, that was a real wake-up call for me. It was like, hold on a second. Like, you don't need to run, you know, a 5K every day to reduce your stress, Michael. You know, there's better ways to do that. And so balance became the most important word in my life after that. And that's really why I wrote the book, was it's really about a balanced idea, having a balanced lifestyle and being able to balance your energy and keep your energy all day long.
Awesome. Very nice. And so speaking of that, and also just, I think people always, at least for me, as someone who still works with clients, are always asking me tips for sleep. What are some things that people can do to get a better quality sleep? And I would say a second part question to that would be, is there a nutritional component to that too, that can help improve that?
So absolutely. There's some easy things that people can do. I'm going to give your listeners a 5-step plan that I think they will love. And then we'll talk about the nutrition component because there is a big nutrition component. So step number one is to wake up at the same time every day, including the weekends. So
oh,
if you wake
man.
up at I know it sucks, dude. Trust me. Everybody hates that part. So if you wake up at 6:30 during the week, I want you waking up at 6:30 on Saturday and Sunday. Now, Michael, why on earth are you putting us through all of this torture? All right, well, let me explain it to you. So the way it works is if you go to bed late on Friday, sleep in on Saturday, go to bed late on Saturday, sleep in on Sunday, Mondays are terrible because you've got what's called social jet lag. You've actually rotated your circadian rhythm by even only sleeping in by a half an hour. You will actually rotate that circadian rhythm and make Monday much, much, much more difficult for you to wake up. So waking up at the exact same time every single day actually is the best thing that you can possibly do. Now, a lot of people will say, well, Michael, I want to catch up on my sleep on the weekends. Newsflash, you can't do that. Okay. It doesn't work. All right. There was a great study that came out about a year ago. People had 5 hours of sleep during the week, 8 hours of sleep on the weekend. We measured their mood, their focus, their attention, and their memory for 6 weeks. Every single week, it went down further and further and further to the point where people were having 30 and 40% decrements. And here's the kicker. Nobody knew it. So when we interviewed the people and we said, how do you feel like you did on your test? They said, oh my God, I aced it. And they were like in the 70s or the 60s, you know, in terms of scores. So what the problem is that people don't realize that they're sleep deprived in many cases. So giving yourself this ultimate wake up at the same time every day is incredibly helpful anchor to everything. Step number two does have to do with a component of nutrition, but not nutrition itself, because we're going to talk about caffeine. So if I had to pick one substance that really messes sleep up, it's caffeine by far. And the big problem is caffeine lasts in your system for a very long period.
Oh, huge half-life.
Yeah, it's got a half-life of between 6 and 8 hours, depending upon how quick of a metabolizer you are. But here's the more interesting fact. It has a quarter life. So 25% of the substance is still in you 12 hours later. So if you have a cup of coffee at 9 o'clock in the morning, I got a news flash for you. 25% of that caffeine is still running around your brain at 9 o'clock at night. So if you can, step number two is to stop caffeine by 2 p.m. That allows us to get at least enough of it out of your system so that you shouldn't have too much of a problem falling asleep. But to be clear, I'd love for people to be decaf, but please don't go cold turkey. I had two patients end up in the ER who went cold turkey off of caffeine. So it's not a pretty sight. Step number three has to do with alcohol, right? Alcohol is the number one sleep aid in the world. And it's the worst one. But look, I like scotch. I like beer. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having a glass of wine with dinner. So how do you do that and still be able to function? Well, there's a couple of ways. From a sleep perspective, if you have one glass of alcohol, you should have one glass of water and you should wait 1 hour before bed. It takes the average human about an hour to digest an alcoholic beverage to get it through your liver and to slow down the effects of alcohol on sleep. Two glasses of wine, you would have two glasses of water and wait 2 hours. You really don't want to take the third drink. And I'll tell you why. Once you hit drink number three, I mean, don't get me wrong, you might want the third drink, but you shouldn't take the third.
I was going to say.
And the reasons why is by the second drink, you're starting to catch a buzz. When you catch a buzz, your brain says something toxic is in my brain and it spikes cortisol. Bad idea to do right before sleep. So now you're an energetic drunk trying to get to sleep. Doesn't really work very well. So if you can, as a general rule, stop drinking alcohol 3 hours before bed, keep it to two drinks and you should be just fine. Step number three is an exercise step. I'm a big fan of exercise. It is an easy, easy way to improve the quality of your sleep. However, if you do it too close to bedtime, your core body temperature is too warm. And when your core body temperature is warm, melatonin cannot be produced. Most people don't realize it, but your core body temperature rises till about 10:30 at night. It hits a crest and then it falls. That fall is actually a signal to the brain to release melatonin. If your body temperature is too high to have that crest and fall, you ain't got no melatonin, right? So step number four, exercise daily, but stop exercise about 4 hours before bed if you possibly can. That way your body has a chance to chill out literally and you have a better shot at sleeping. And then step number five has to do with morning routines. There's three things that I ask everybody to do every morning and they won't cost you a dime. Step number one is when you wake up, hopefully without an alarm, but at a very consistent time, I want you to swing your legs over to the side of the bed and take 15 deep breaths. On the last five breaths, you want to have some sort of an intention for the day. Like, I want to be open today. I want to do well today. Something very positive in your day, but while breathing to bring yourself present. The second thing you want to do is walk over to the window and get 15 minutes of sunlight. If you can, I prefer walk outside. While you're walking, you should have grabbed a glass of water and drink 15 ounces of water. So you're going to do 15 deep breaths, drink 15 ounces of water, and spend 15 minutes in the sun. If you do those three things every morning, your mornings will be glorious. You will wake up, you will have great energy. And there's specific reasons with the sunlight that you want to do that very consistently as well. Also, if you have the opportunity to watch the sun rise or to watch the sun set, that actually can be incredibly helpful for your photoreceptors in your eye to help you with sleep.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. I think I just want to let you know, college me is definitely, you know, I ran my own experiment, my own sleep study. It was called College on Catching Up in Sleep.
And, I hear you, brother.
Let's just say I kind of confirmed the results that you guys got too. I didn't, that and the alcohol just didn't, you know. Okay. Very, very interesting. And now, so Gary and I have wondered a lot about a nutritional influence here as well. And there's a lot of different ways you could take this. You know, you mentioned caffeine, for example. We were curious if you have any experience working with people who are on lower carbohydrate approaches, possibly trying to drive up their ketone levels in one way or another.
So the answer is yes. And it's interesting because, you know, when you look at lowering carbohydrates, that actually can have a direct effect on your ability to fall asleep. As an example, one of the things that I talk about with a lot of my patients is I say, well, don't go to bed hungry, but also, you know, don't go to bed full. And so they say, well, what can I do? Now, these are for my non-ketogenic patients. To be clear, I'll ask them to have a snack, about 250 calories, and I would say make it 70% carbs and about 30% protein or fat. People are like, carbs before bed? Michael, you're insane. That's terrible. Why are you doing that? Blah, blah, blah. One very specific reason. The ingestion of carbohydrates increases serotonin. When you increase serotonin, it calms the brain down, lowers the cortisol, and allows people to fall asleep easier. So if you can keep it to a 250 calorie snack, it works well. Now, the question you have for me, since you guys work with people who do ketogenic diets and work with ketones, is what if we don't want them to have carbohydrates before bed? What if we want to make sure that their nutrition is solid and that we don't want to be affecting their sleep in a negative way? And so we were speaking a little bit before we got on air that there's this thing called the keto flu, right? Which is when people start to go keto, they actually have a tremendous amount of protein in their system and it ends up being very alerting for them, in fact. So the question then becomes, is it the excess protein that's making them more alert or is it the lack of carbohydrates that's making them more alert? It could be both. To be honest with you, that's not my area of research, but what I can tell you is that one of the things I have found very effective is if I change the schedule of the diet of the individual to match their chronotype. So as an example, I'm a night owl. And so if I'm going to eat, I make sure that I can't eat breakfast. It just makes me sick. So I end up eating later in the day and I push my entire schedule based on my chronotype. And it actually works out pretty well.
Interesting. So, Gary, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, thanks, Dr. Bruce. We've also seen that tryptophan has a very interesting effect on serotonin production. And is that a supplement people, do you think, could take during their conversion or transition from a high carb to a low carb diet?
It would make intuitive sense to me that would be something that they could do. You know, when you look historically at tryptophan, most people think turkey, most people think milk, things of that nature. You're talking more about the actual supplement of taking a supplement of tryptophan.
You're exactly right. The amino acid itself. Yeah.
Right. Because if you look at the data, you'd have to eat like a 40 pound turkey, right?
That would be right before one of these five meals for sure. Yeah.
Dude, even in my best days in college, I don't think I could eat a 40-pound turkey. And tryptophan doesn't work great in the presence of protein either.
You'd have to chase that of alcohol.
Right. God forbid. Right. That would be an even bigger mess. But no, I think that, you know, right. when you think about tryptophan and where it is in the melatonin cycle and how it helps to with the conversion of that, tryptophan could be a very effective something for people who are working with a ketogenic diet. Absolutely.
Now, one of the things we've noticed that when people are they're in a ketogenic state where they take exogenous ketones, that there is a buildup of adenosine. And that adenosine actually seems to really help with sleep. And I think that's probably because it restricts or promotes serotonin, and it also promotes melatonin.
So in fact, adenosine is the neurotransmitter that helps kick off the process of sleep. So when a cell eats a piece of glucose and something comes out the back end, one of those things is adenosine. Adenosine actually works its way through the system and goes to a very specific area of receptor sites in your brain. And as it accumulates, you get sleepier and sleepier and sleepier. So if the data suggests that being on a ketogenic diet or taking exogenous ketones will increase adenosine, then it makes intuitive sense to me that it would help people fall asleep much more quickly.
Interesting. Interesting. And we also mentioned privately offline, Gary can kind of back this up too, but ketones have a very GABAergic effect. So they're actually helping being pro-GABA, which would also help, right?
Yeah. So remember GABA, I call it the brakes of the brain. Right. And so anything that increases GABA slows everything down, which can be very, very helpful from an anxiety standpoint, from just a autonomic nervous system standpoint. If we can, that's one of the easiest ways to slow the sympathetic nervous system is to increase GABA.
Interesting. So Gary and I also were looking at studies that showed exogenous ketones can reduce anxiety rates by, Gary, it was like as much as 40%, right? And I believe, Dr. Bruce, you've talked about the importance of stress management, I guess, both biologically and in your life, right, on sleep, right? That's a factor?
It's a huge factor. I would argue that anxiety and stress, 75% of the insomnia or sleeplessness or disrupted sleep that I see is anxiety, has a component in it for sure. So being able to maybe, you know, take ketones where it would then increase GABA, increase your tryptophan or adenosine rather, and maybe help you be able to fall asleep. It could make intuitive sense to me. I would imagine that you would need to take something like that in the evenings though. I wouldn't want you to take something like that as a morning supplement. I don't think that would go over too well.
Got it. Interesting. Okay. And Gary, you were talking privately offline about the effect of, some of the effects of different waves of sleep, right? And different phases of sleep.
Yeah, I think it'd be great if Dr. Bruce took us through the different stages of sleep, because I think that as I study ketones and its impact on brain waves, not only in sleep, but in other aspects, I'm getting more and more excited about sleep because it does some things that nothing else does.
Right.
In terms of the way the body responds. So yeah, absolutely. If you could take us through those stages for the listeners, I think that'd be awesome.
Absolutely. So the sleep is broken up into two categories. One is called REM sleep. The other is called non-REM sleep. And non-REM sleep is broken down into three, depending upon who you talk to, three or four stages. So stage one sleep is purely a transition, going from wakefulness to unconsciousness. It doesn't last very long, 3-4 minutes. It makes up maybe 2-3% of the night in total, but it is the transition or kind of opening the door, if you will, to sleep. Stage two there's a lot of controversy surrounding the importance of stage two. Stage two makes up over 50% of the night usually. So it's important, but the question is, do we really need that much stage two sleep? For what it does, it seems to help several different processes, specifically memory and consolidation of different pieces of data. that have been coming through you based on spindles and K complexes, but that gets super duper complicated. I would think about stage two as the thing that leads you to stage three and four. Stage three and four is your physical restoration. This is where we see the largest bolus of growth hormone emitted. This is where we see the most repair, muscular repair, cellular repair occurring. Also during stages three and four, we have something called the glymphatic system comes in and cleans out the brain. It cleans out the brain of two very specific proteins. One is called beta amyloid. The other one is called tau. Those two proteins in particular are very devastational. As they build up in the brain, they will surround a nerve ending and strangle it, and that's called dementia. And so we want those to be filtered out as best we can. And so getting that good stage three, four sleep helps with that glymphatic process. So that becomes very, very important. Now moving on to REM sleep, which stands for rapid eye movement sleep. This is a very unique stage of sleep in that it does some very unique things. One, most people know it because many people dream during this stage of sleep. We know that you can actually dream in any stage of sleep, but 85% of the time, if we wake somebody up from REM sleep, they will report some type of a dream. It also actually helps with your mental restoration. This is really where we see the memory consolidation going on. So this is basically where you're moving information from your short-term memory to your long-term memory, or like your floppy disk to your hard drive. I don't even know if people have floppy disks anymore, but you know what I'm trying to say. So that aspect happens during REM sleep. Also, a lot of emotional processing occurs during REM sleep in particular. Dreaming, we think, at least we hypothesize, that it is a way to work through many of the emotions that you may be having during the day. When you wake up in the middle of an emotional dream, it's called a nightmare, and your ability to process those emotions stops until you get back into that dream. This is why nightmares have a tendency to be repetitive and almost haunting to people, is because they have to get back into that dream and allow it to occur. Also during REM sleep, some other interesting things occur. One of the big ones is you become paralyzed, completely and totally paralyzed. Most people don't know this, and they certainly don't know the reasoning behind it. And this is so that you do not act out your dreams. If you do not have this paralytic mechanism, you will get up and dance around or whatever it is you're doing in your dream. This could be a problem from a safety perspective, primarily, but also it gives us an indication that there could be something going on from a brain perspective. We know that in 35% of cases of people who have this situation, which we call REM behavior disorder, again, where people act out their dreams, in 35% of those cases, it's a precursor for Parkinson's syndrome. So we really want to know when that's going on in people. And so REM is one of those situations where if something is going wrong in REM, you may have a big problem going on. And I tell this to people all the time, you know, if you feel as though your sleep is disrupted, if you're waking up multiple times throughout the night, if you wake up after a night's sleep and you don't feel refreshed or rested, that's a window into your mental health or your physical health. Sleep is the perfect, you know, spyglass to be able to see what's really going on. Because most times, if your sleep is messed up, something else is doing it.
So one of the things that I've read is, where does the slow wave energy come into a sleep profile? Is it during the stage two?
Stages three and four is primarily where we see the slow wave sleep. In stage two, we see these things called K complexes, which is a single waveform that would be a slow wave, but we don't see repetitive slow waves until we actually get into stages three and four, or what we call deep sleep.
So there's a difference between frequency and amplitude at that point, correct?
Correct. 100%.
And one of the things we've seen with ketones is it has the ability to supply a slower wave, higher amplitude energy than, say, a busy glucose brain.
Mm-hmm. And so that wouldn't surprise me at all.
And this has really been very instrumental in helping children deal with their epilepsy problems.
And that I'm unaware of. I don't work with that population group, although I do know that we do have patients who have seizure disorders, and we know that if they're not sleeping well in terms of the restorative nature of their sleep, we know that the frequency of those seizures goes up significantly. So it might make sense that if you gave somebody ketones who had seizures And it improved the amplitude and the frequency of their delta waves, that it might slow something down in the seizure department. But again, that's outside my realm.
Yeah. So just it almost goes to it almost begs the question as to whether or not ketones, with its really preferred type of low frequency, high amplitude energy, couldn't also play a very significant role in that deep sleep process, as well as modulating perhaps some things that are happening in REM.
So, yeah, I mean, I could absolutely see. I mean, if it changes the amplitude in slow wave, then there's a reasonable likelihood that it could change amplitude in REM as well. But I'd have to like dive deep into the data to really kind of get a feel on that.
So one of the things that was interesting, I read an article a little while ago. There was an article back, or a study back in 2008, on sleep and low carb diets, very low carb diets. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they said is that that they found that REM was reduced, but slow wave deep sleep was increased. But they also saw that it was almost a better pairing of the two during the evening. So sometimes people have too little deep sleep, too much REM sleep, and vice versa. And the study seemed to point out that it more balanced that sleep profile.
So when you look at those types of pieces of information, I would say maybe. At the end of the day, the brain does a really good job of figuring out how much of each stage you need based on its understanding of when it thinks you're going to wake up. This is one of the reasons why I tell everybody wake up at the exact same time every day, because then your brain kind of knows how much time it's got to fill in the gaps, if you will. So the brain does do a fairly good job of that. But if you had somebody, let's say, that had a curtailed schedule where they were only sleeping 5 hours a night, or something along those lines, then there might be a situation where that could make sense to try to balance something like that out. But the brain does a pretty decent job of it on its own.
Perhaps it could be kind of an indirect lever or mechanism to pull by which a nutritional program that's highly improving your neurological system, your brain, would then make your brain healthier, which could then maybe help your brain do the jobs that it's meant to do, like this one, better, you know, even if it's not a direct manipulation of the lever itself.
Yeah, I mean, tangentially speaking, there's so many different things that can kind of be a nutritional sure. influence,
right?
You know, and
inflammation, all that stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, and it also, I think it begs the question, an interesting question, which is, you know, are we talking about, I mean, we're not obviously talking about total carbohydrate deprivation, but, you know, maybe what would happen if we just looked at processed carbohydrates? Versus, you know what I'm saying, versus naturally occurring carbohydrates, and seeing what those differences might be. Because I have a sneaking suspicion that sugar is at the bottom of a lot of people's problems, because we know that processed food and processed sugar is really just not good for your health, makes everything function poorly. And of course, that has an effect on sleep as well.
So the other thing that's very interesting to me with sleep is the different morbidities. I think that people who have Alzheimer's, or they have mild cognitive defect, or even dementia, they don't sleep as well.
No, they don't. Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, here's the thing to remember is sleep affects every organ system and every disease state, right? And so if you're obese, your sleep is going to be affected, and your sleep is going to affect your obesity. If you've got cardiac issues, the same holds true there. If you've got diabetes, you know, same holds true there. So I agree with you. Sleep is kind of that, it's kind of that fundamental aspect where when you start to look at comorbidities, you start to see, wow, if this person slept better, that morbidity would probably get better. It might not fix it. Just to be clear, if you fix somebody's sleep, that doesn't make their depression magically disappear, right? Or their anxiety magically disappear, or their diabetes. But if you get them sleeping well on a consistent schedule with healthy sleep, those things do get better for sure.
And I think one of the things you mentioned was beta amyloids. Mm-hmm. There's been some very interesting studies with ketones and beta amyloids.
Okay.
And the accumulation of beta amyloid is pretty much related to glucose.
yep.
and glucose type of plaques. So somebody who's in a ketogenic state or in ketosis as they're asleep, or in fact, while they're awake, there's less of accumulation, we believe, in those beta amyloids in the brain. And maybe it even can facilitate how much faster or more efficient REM can move those out of there.
I mean, it would be interesting. That is definitely not my area of expertise, but I mean, just thinking through it, like from a logical perspective, it would be an experiment worth running in a research lab for sure. Like I would love to see what would happen if we put somebody on, you know, a pure ketogenic diet and had them take exogenous ketones, and then were able to measure or, you know, do a cerebral blood flow MRI study and look at, you know, what's going on during stage 3-4 sleep and see if it actually is doing that. Because there's people who've done some of those studies. I want to say Ev Coulter out of University or Northeastern University had done some of that original work looking at blood sugar in sleep. And I think she's also done some of that glymphatic work. So there's definitely an area that could be interesting for that. I'd be remiss if I said I wouldn't be surprised if it had a small effect, but I just don't know how big of an effect it would have. It'd be pretty cool though. I mean, if you think about it, if all you had to do was take ketones and you could lower the risk for Alzheimer's and dementia, that'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, that would be actually really awesome. I think the other thing is when people are in a, you know, when people have cognitive decline, one of the things that's been noticed through brain scans is those centers that affect sleep also get energy deprived. So the same areas that get energy deprived in the brain for the memory also get energy deprived during a sleep cycle.
What do you mean by energy deprived?
Okay. Well, when the brain can't process glucose properly, then you get a brain deficit. You get an energy deficit in the brain. And it's been that study right now, pretty intense study. Like Stephen Cunane is doing some very intense studies on how do you accelerate or how do you heighten brain energy. And when you increase brain energy, it has an amazing effect on memory and retaining memory. And there you go with REM being so important and deep sleep being so important and memory consolidation, I can't help but thinking a energy deficit wouldn't be a really big problem in sleep.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a great question. Memory is really more a function on the REM side than on the slow wave sleep side. Slow wave sleep side is more that glymphatic system we were talking about, but you need that in order to have good neurologic function. So I definitely think they work hand in hand. I don't know the answer. I would be curious to see the studies and learn more about what some people are doing there, but I think it's definitely a pretty valid line of research to start walking down that path and start to see what's going on there. But I mean, you're talking about a major research effort if you really wanted to get into the nitty gritty and mechanism of action.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that's why we've got a lot of failure on the Alzheimer's side is that there's been almost $1 trillion spent. And where are we?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole area of literature that I can't say that I know incredibly well, but I can say from a sleep perspective, there are not as many researchers who are looking at that as I would love to see looking at that, because I agree with you. I think that there could be some fundamental aspects to these devastating neurologic situations that sleep could either repair or help people in a significant way. And it would be really interesting to see if ketones would affect that as well.
Yeah, I think all of us too also are just thinking in general, we tend to think polymathematically about the interrelatedness of all of these things too. You also had hit on something earlier that I think was important to touch on, and that's that early on in kind of the adaptation window, you might notice that you're going to be getting worse sleep, but that does go away in time, you said, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I very rarely have I had it last longer than a week. Okay. Sometimes it's as short as 3 days, 4 days. And what I tell people is, look, if you're going to start a ketogenic diet, like expect it, that you're going to have difficulty sleeping, but you still need to get in bed at the same time and get out of bed at the same time. You don't need to worry about your sleep, because that's the other thing that people do, right? So sleep, I would argue that sleep is based off of two fundamental principles. One is discipline, the other is acceptance, okay? So the discipline comes with all the things we talked about before, right? So get up right at the same time, stop caffeine at 2 o'clock, blah, blah, blah. Acceptance is you can do everything right and still get crappy sleep, okay? And that happens. Look, I'm a sleep doctor, okay? And I get crappy sleep every once in a while. I always use the same example. If something's going on with my daughter, I don't sleep well. It's just a fact. It doesn't matter what goes on in my life. And I have to accept that and know, okay, well, something's going on with Carson. I know I'm not going to sleep that great tonight, but I do know that if I lie here and get what's called non-sleep deep rest. So there's a whole movement kind of going on with this idea of non-sleep deep rest, which is just lying there relaxing. And that's what I would recommend for people who are starting out on a ketogenic diet, is go to bed at your normal time. If you don't sleep, that's okay. Rest. That your body will still get some fundamentally good things from that. You will get some rejuvenation from that. And over the course of time, it goes away.
Can you talk somewhat on blue light?
Sure.
Yeah, I was actually going to mention that in a second, just as kind of a little adjunct to Gary's question. Just, we gave some tangible advice to people at home. And one thing that we've talked about previously on here is, you know, possibly replacing some of your light bulbs and a couple key lamps you have on at night with amber bulbs, blue light blockers on phone. Could you mind kind of giving a couple of tips for people there?
All right. So I'm going to bottom line it for blue light with you guys. Okay. Because there's a gazillion people out there doing a gazillion different things. And full disclosure, I have my own line of blue light blocking glasses. Okay.
Oh, interesting.
It's called sleep doctor glasses. Here's the thing. Do not wear blue light blocking glasses during the day. Stop it. Okay. Just don't do it. It's stupid. It doesn't do you any good. You need blue light blocking glasses approximately 90 minutes before lights out. Okay. And by the way, it also depends upon how much light exposure you got during the day as to how much blue light will affect you at night. That's a very complicated way of looking at it. So what I tell people is, if you're going to want to avoid blue light, which I do recommend, put on your blue light blockers about 90 minutes before bed. Should you change the bulbs in your bedside table lamps? Sure. Nothing wrong with doing that. That's actually a great way of being able to lower the frequency of the blue light that's being able to be emitted. I think that can be helpful. When you look at the phones, like night shift on your Apple phone, it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. All it does is lower the brightness, not the color temperature. So the way you would think about it is, if you remember, I'm going to date myself. We used to have a thing called a stereo, and on this thing called a stereo, there was a volume knob, there was a bass knob, and there was a treble knob. So I don't know if anybody out there still remembers what those are. I'm 53. So yeah, I certainly,
I do. Yes.
Thank you, Gary. I feel better now. So what the computer's screen does is it lowers the volume, not changes the treble or the bass, if you will.
Got it.
Okay. And so that's why that one in particular doesn't work, the one on the phone. Now there is a computer one that works very, very well, and it's called Flux, F-L-U-X. It's free. You can download it and put it onto your laptop, and you put a timer on it, and it will automatically change the color temperature. And that way you can actually utilize that. It's free. I recommend it to people all the time. Do me a favor. Do not go around your bedroom with black electrical tape and start covering up every little blue dot. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Okay.
Do people actually do that?
People do that. It's unbelievable. People
get so into this. Oh my God. You got to be kidding. I can barely remember what time to go to bed.
Yeah. They're more concerned with running around covering up the blue dots than getting to bed at a regular time. Right?
So, like, you call that majoring in the minors, right?
Right. Exactly. Majoring in the minors. That's perfect. I love that. So don't do that silly stuff. But, you know, again, understand how light affects you. There's some great data to look at the ability of sunset to help with photoreception. So if you actually dig into this data, it's pretty interesting. But if you watch the sunset, the photoreceptors in your eyes will do some things that are kind of cool that will actually lower the amount of blue light that's allowed to be emitted for the rest of the night. So it's kind of cool. Also, the same thing happens, by the way, if you watch sunrise. So if you watch sunrise, you get more blue light in, which is really good, actually helps with photo reception during the daytime. Then you watch sunset. It actually, and by the way, it's pretty damn relaxing to do that. Like find somebody who you care about and, you know, watch sunset together. Number one, it breaks up your day, which is a good thing. But number two, it really can be helpful. Now, if you're going to go forward and buy blue light blocking glasses or do some kind of blue light effect, let me give you some important information. There's three different things you have to block if you're going to block blue light. One is the frequency. So between 460 and 480 nanometers is the frequency within the light spectrum that we're trying to block. By the way, it's not actually called blue. It's called cyan, but everybody calls it blue.
Yeah.
That's number one is break up the frequency. Number two is you want to change the brightness. This is the reason why we have those amber lenses. If anybody out there buys a clear pair of blue light blocking glasses, you've been sold a bill of goods because it isn't going to be effective at all. It may have a coating that blocks that frequency, but if you don't block the brightness, you're not going to be able to do nearly as good. And the third thing is the angle, right? And so when you've got a pair of glasses on, you want them to actually circle almost the entire orbit, because getting this blue light in from the sides is not going to be helpful because it's not going to be blocked. So you want to have something that's, you don't need goggles to be clear. You just want some that are like, you know, like sunglasses size that will be able to block the blue light. You want them to have the coating and you want them to be amber. If you've got all three of those things, you've got a decent pair of blue light blocking glasses. And like I said,
like the 90 minutes like orbit. Like the glasses we used to wear when we listened to the stereo.
Yes, exactly.
That's funny. Well, hey, Dr. Bruce, I know we're almost out of time here, and I want to be very respectful of that. So it sounds like you would need glasses one way or another if you're going to look at your phone, even if your phone has a flux setting on it.
Yeah, exactly. So like as an example, if I wake up before the sun comes up, I have a pair of blue light blocking glasses that sits right next to my bedside. I'll put those on. I'll walk down into the hall because that's where I charge my phone. And I might pick up my phone to, if I've decided, hey, I want to do my meditation this morning or I want to check something this morning, but I'll be, if it's still dark out, I'll put my blue light blocking glasses on to be able to maintain that melatonin production if I want it. Maybe I want to go back to sleep or something along those lines. If I don't want it and I say, hey, it's 5:30 and I want to get up, but it's still dark out, then I actually have a light box. So I own a couple of different light boxes out there so I can start my own sunshine in my office if that's what I want to do. And you can do that as well. Personally, what I do is if it's still dark out, I like to meditate and then I like to do my breath work as the sun rises. And so it's kind of a nice way for me to start my day.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, hey, Gary and I have loved having you on. Where can people go to learn more about your work, including your book? And you mentioned the Chrono resource too, that people can customize, right?
So if you want to learn more about what your chronotype is, which I highly recommend because it will really help you out in a lot of different ways, go to chronoquiz.com for folks out there. That's chronoquiz.com. And if you want to learn more about my new book, go to energizemyself.com and you can learn all about it. And we have a great pre-order program where if you pre-order the book, I'm going to do a video series where I'm going to teach you all the cool stuff in the book and you'll be able to start your program right away.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. And then if people want to buy the glasses too.
If people are interested in the glasses, go to sleepdoctorglasses.com or just go to my website, thesleepdoctor.com, and under products, you'll see all the products that I have either created because I didn't like what was out there or that I endorse because the science is really good.
Perfect. And I'll make sure to provide links in the show notes to your social media, official website, book, and everything that we just discussed too. So
amazing. Thanks, guys.
Dr. Bruce, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
It was nice meeting you.
Yeah, it was great to meet you as well. It's my absolute pleasure. And I'm very interested to learn more about that adenosine data. And if there's an increase in adenosine based on exogenous ketones, that could be a real interesting aspect to people who have adenosine reduction or who just don't produce a lot of adenosine. So I'm excited to learn more about that. So thank you.
Yeah, we'll be in touch for sure. All right, everybody at home, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of BHB Radio. I know I learned a ton from Dr. Bruce. I've got a ton of notes I need to kind of take out of hieroglyphic mode and turn into organized action mode. So we'll see you guys next time here at BHB Radio.